This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or to find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Blue Cliff Record, case 98. Tian Ping's travels on foot, the pointer. Collecting the causes, producing the results, completing the beginning, completing the end. Face to face, there's nothing hidden. But fundamentally, I've never explained. If there's suddenly someone who comes forth and says, all summer we've been asking for instruction, why have you never explained? Wait till you've awakened, and then I'll tell you. I respond. Tell me, do you think that this is avoidance of direct confrontation, or do you think it has some other merit? To test, I cite this to see, the main case. When the master of Tian Ping was traveling on foot, he called on Zi Wan. Tian Ping would always say, do not say you understand the Buddhist teaching. I can't find a single person who can quote a saying. One day, Zi Wan saw him from a distance and called out to him, Tian Ping. Ping raised his head. Zi Wan said, wrong. Ping went two or three steps. Zi Wan again said, wrong. Ping approached him. Zi Wan said, these two wrongs now, just now, were they my wrongs or your wrongs? Ping said, my wrongs. Zi Wan said, wrong. Ping gave up. Zi Wan said, why don't you stay here for the summer and wait for me to discuss these two wrongs with you? But Ping immediately went away. Later, when he was dwelling in a temple, he said to the Sangha, when I was first traveling on foot, I was blown by the wind of events to Zi Wan's place. Twice in a row, he said wrong and tried to keep me there over the summer to wait for him to deal with me. I didn't say it was wrong then, but when I set out for the south, I already knew that it was wrong. The verse. Followers of the Chan house like to be scornful. Having studied till their bellies are full, they cannot put it to use. How lamentable, laughable, old Tian Ping. After all, he says at the outset, it was regrettable to go travel on foot. Wrong, wrong. Zi Wan's pure wind suddenly melts him. You know, within the history and the development of koans, the koan literature, which is a particular way of training, it's a particular way of practicing Zazen. But more than that, because Zazen is more than that, it's a way of engaging, of turning towards phenomena. How are we to be free within this life means how do we be free within phenomena? Phenomena is a world, is a word for everything. Everything that we experience, that we call our world, inside, outside, past, present, and future, everything that we perceive. And so we have to turn towards phenomena. We have to turn towards the world. And the Buddha realized we have to fundamentally turn towards the world of the self, because that's the basis of everything. That is the world. But we have to learn how to turn and how to see. And so whether we're practicing the breath or doing shikantaza or a koan or practicing visualization or mantra practice, whether we're doing liturgy, doing work practice, art and body practice, all of these different forms of training, traditional and those on the fly. It's all about this. The point to when he says collecting the causes, producing the result, completing the beginning, completing the end, this is where practice takes place. There's an action and there's a consequence. That's how we got here. That's how suffering is created, and it's how suffering is alleviated. If we don't understand cause and effect, then there's little hope, little chance that we will make much progress in shift. And at every step, as we are nothing but cause and effect, at every step there's the truth that nothing is coming into being. It's said in the sutras that cause and effect, dependent origination, are the teachings that we need to help us begin to learn how to turn towards reality so that we can understand fundamentally the liberation from cause and effect, which isn't what we think that means. It's really the fulfillment of the bodhisattva vows. And then he says, fundamentally, I've never explained anything to you. So this is at the very end of this collection of koans. And so the pointer, Yan Wu, who was putting all these together, no doubt was thinking about the fact that, you know, this is, he's coming to the end of this collection of koans, of teachings. Face to face, there's nothing hidden, but fundamentally, I've never explained it. Through all of these previous koans, I've never explained it to you. That's really the point of the koan, is to not explain it to you. Because once we receive the explanation, then it becomes a dead thing. It's something we know. It just goes into our catalog of known things. There's no life in it. I've never explained it to you. So if suddenly somebody comes forth and says, you know, all summer we've been asking for instruction, why don't you ever explain anything? And so Yan Wu response is, wait until you have awakened and then I'll tell you. Wait until you're awakened and then you will know that nothing was ever hidden. You will know that although I've never explained anything to you, I've never held anything back. And in a sense, that's the basic situation of the Buddha Dharma. That nothing is held back, nothing is hidden. And in its presence, we are hidden. We are hidden. And so it's as though it can't be seen. And so we seek an explanation, because explanations are nice. You know, somebody explains something to you, now you've got that. It's something you can tuck in your pocket and carry with you. And of course, there are many things in which explanation works, helps, but not this. And so it's said that if a teacher explains too much, their eyebrows fall out. If you don't explain too much, if you have big, bushy eyebrows, that's considered like you've done a good job. So I'm not doing so well, I guess. You know, and the Buddha realized from the very beginning this challenge that was before him, because what he experienced in his enlightenment, as he said, cannot be perceived by the senses. So what do we rely on? What do we turn towards? How do we study phenomena? And so when we come into practice, we come in having deep faith, more than we even know or have even thought about probably, in our senses, in their ongoing conveyance to us of what's real, of what's going on, of who we are, of who you are. And then that evolves into thoughts and ideas and beliefs, and there we have it. And so when we begin sitting and just facing the multitude of all of that knowledge, all of the experience perceived through the senses, the practice is to just not deny, but don't build anymore for the moment. Don't build something new. And in that, we gain stability. We begin to gain stability. Time begins to resume its natural state. There's time enough to see, time enough to respond, time enough to discern. And so within the moving mind, we cease into wakefulness. Within the arising of thoughts and ideas, we relax into direct experience. And we gain faith. We begin gaining faith and confidence. And we could say in the teachings, but really the teachings are just being verified. We're experiencing, living the truth of them, which is really the essential thing. And so it's said that faith begins when we encounter a teacher or somebody who embodies such wisdom or a teaching that inspires us, and that within some part of us we know that there's something about this that is true. And then that gives rise to a longing faith in which we long to have a piece of that. We long to experience that for ourselves. You know, through so much of my training, when I would encounter teachings that I didn't understand, which was so much of the time, that there was that sense of not understanding, but there was also the sense of, I want to understand what you understand. I want to see what you are seeing. And so that longing faith, which is very strong motivation, and then through practice, we begin to verify. And that faith becomes confidence. And it's interesting how faith becomes something else, right? When it's no longer based in what is not yet our experience, when it becomes our experience, it becomes something else. We can speak of it as confidence, experience, direct experience. And then ultimately, it's said that there's irreversible faith, you know, because that faith that we have is so sort of fragile and precarious because things happen and we feel like, okay, I never knew anything, I never saw anything, it's all gone, right? And these waves of doubt can arise. And that begins to shift as we realize, no, that's not true. This is just, I'm encountering something that's not clear. I'm encountering something I don't yet understand. I'm at the limit of my ability to see. And irreversible faith is when it's not that we've seen all there is to see, experienced all there is to experience, know all there is to know, but rather, we've seen enough, know enough, to know that the very idea of turning back is illusory. Where would we go? I remember long before there was anything I could consider irreversible faith, sitting in this zendo, struggling, you know, doubting, and thinking, I don't know if I can do this. You know, I don't know if I can do this. And then I would think, maybe I should just go, you know. And then I would realize, but anywhere I go, there I go. Right? Like, what am I going away from or to? Where am I going to go that I'm not there? And that's really it can feel like great doubt, but it's really the seat of our wisdom, of our power, spiritual power. And so along the road, it's really essential that there be many, many tests, many trials, right? And you don't really have to go out of your way to find them. Just wake up. Get out of bed. Maybe before you get out of bed. There they are. And training is a part of that. Training isn't intended to make you as comfortable as possible. In order for us to really awaken to a true state of relaxation, which is really liberation from dukkha, which is a state of heightened unrest. Samsara is a state of heightened dis-ease. In order, because of the entanglement, the training creates certain tensions, stresses, tests, Some are quite intentional, and some just happen by virtue of being, living, being yourself, having brought yourself here, in which we are able to see what is difficult to see, practice, which you can't practice until there it is in your face. And so this koan I find very interesting. You know, there are koans that really give us a window into a person's journey. They don't explain anything. The nature of koans, they don't do that. They don't give us the biographies and the inner workings and the stories going on within people's mind. That's the point. The point is to be able to see right just what's being presented and to not get fixated on that, not to ignore it, but not get fixated on that and to be able to see more deeply, not by conjecture, not by interpretation, not through metaphor or symbols, but by, in a sense, seeing your own mind, your nature, your self-nature, your practice in this moment. And so Tian Ping is a practitioner of some, maturity, who's traveling on foot, and it said right at the beginning that he would often say, I can't find a single person who can quote a saying of the Buddhist teaching. So right there, Tian Ping is presenting himself to us. What do we see? In the commentary, it says, Tian Ping had called on various masters, and because he had gone to various places and attained this turnip chan, I don't think I need to define, to decipher that, turnip chan, and put it into his belly. Everywhere he went, he scornfully opened his big mouth and said, I understand, chan, I understand the way. And would say, I can't find a single person who can quote the Buddha's teaching. And so this is how he arrives. And we each arrive in our own way, sometimes quite broadcasted, sometimes a little more subtly, but always transparent. And so one day, Zhiyuan called out to him and said, Tian Ping. And Tian Ping turned to him, and Zhiyuan said, wrong. So what is that? Recently I spoke about humility, the practice of humility, and how important humility is as a practice, and how interesting it is, because there are certain practices that you can really cultivate. You can bring them forth. How do you bring forth humility in a way that's genuine? And I spoke about how really it's inherent with sincere practice, when we really are encountering the truth of things, the truth of our delusion, the truth of our attachments, of our karmic entanglements, the truth of the wonder of the way, that humility naturally comes forth. If it doesn't, something's happening. Dogen says, when the Dharma fills our body and mind, then we realize something is missing. The closer we get, the more we realize how vast and boundless it is, the more that humility naturally arises at the same time that we're gaining confidence. And the commentary says, before the Buddha had appeared in the world, before the ancestors had arrived to teach, before there were questions and answers, before there were koans, was there any chan way? The ancients couldn't avoid imparting teachings according to the potentials of people. And people later called them public cases, called them koans. The World Honored One raised a flower. Makai Shapa smiled. The transmission was given. But what special transmission did he give? Before the flower was raised, before Ananda asked the Buddha, what did you receive? Where do you find any koans? And so from within the koan, within the teaching and practice of the koan, Yan Wu, the commentator here, is basically saying, These are all skillful means. Use them well. Don't use them not well. Understand them. Dogen has a whole fascicle in which he talks at a quite extended length about how the Buddha never talked about Zen. He never said there's a Zen tradition, a Zen path, a Zen school. And it's also true that he never spoke about anything else. I remember encountering these teachings in my early studies, you know, which are basically, you know, from within the tradition, from within the teachings, saying, don't confuse these. Don't turn these into something they're not. And that really got my interest, like, wow. Like that kind of safeguard about attachment and about turning this into some kind of self-righteousness. In the Lakavatara Sutra, the Buddha said, I am not concealing anything when I say that wisdom is not obtained from an objective world, from outside. Because this would consist of nothing but the assertion of your own projections onto those objects. When you perceive that what exists or doesn't exist is nothing but a perception of your own mind, and that anything outside does not exist in and of itself, then you know, without perceiving objects, then you know, because you're not perceiving objects. It is because nothing is perceived that the knowledge of something knowable does not arise. And in essence, this is the essence. How do we turn towards phenomena so that we can ultimately realize phenomena has not arisen? How can we have respect for and revere these teachings and give ourselves to them fully and know that in these teachings, nothing inherently exists? The power they have in and of themselves is their alignment with reality, the depth to which they express the truth of this world and our own nature. The power they have within us is equal to our ability and willingness and faith in practicing them. In essence, this koan is just about that. Zhiyuan calls out to Chan Ping. Ping raises his head and Zhiyuan says, wrong. Chan Ping takes a few steps towards him. Zhiyuan says, wrong. And then Zhiyuan approaches him and says, these two wrongs just now, were they yours or mine? And Zhiyuan says, they were mine. And Zhiyuan says, wrong. And there are many koans that in which there is calling and answering. What is this? Calling and answering. Zhiyuan, Chan Ping wasn't waiting to be called. He wasn't expecting this. He was just there within himself. We don't know. But in that moment, Zhiyuan called out to him, Chan Ping. And he did what all of us would do. He turned. And Zhiyuan said, wrong. In the entire universe, there is nothing inherent that we can find that we could call wrong. Why does he say wrong? Really, to show face to face, nothing is hidden. In this very moment, nothing is hidden. But why does he say wrong? How does that bring this out? So to enter into the koan, you have to enter into Chan Ping. You are the one standing there. Not imagining yourself as someone. You are the one standing there. You are being called to. You turn your head wrong. Each and every step is a Buddha action. When we don't see, then everything is divided up into right and wrong. And wrong has a particular power. Who doesn't have a lifetime of history with wrong? I've told this story before about when I was in music school, and I was studying with a teacher that I came to be very close to over the year. It took a while, because he was very intimidating. He was a very sweet guy, but he was haughty. He was a little haughty and self-possessed, but he was also an excellent teacher. And so he asked a question one day in class, very beginning of the semester of my first class with him. And he asked a question, and he asked it in a way that was a little charged. You know, like, do you dare answer this question? And everybody was like, not me. And I'm sitting there thinking, screw this. I'm paying for this. So I stuck up my hand, and I answered the question, and he looked at me. And then he turned around, walked to the board, picked up a piece of chalk, and drew a very, very small zero. Not a big zero, but like hardly worth drawing. Then he turned back and said, any other questions, any other answers? So it's like, that's our worst nightmare, right? Wrong. And because of that, what happens in that moment? Right? What worlds are brought into being? And in those worlds being brought into being, what is being missed? What are we not seeing? How else could we know until we come to that place? And so he takes a few steps and he calls out to him again. He says, wrong. And then he, you know, really like oozing with generosity, comes up to John Ping and says, these wrongs just now, are they mine or yours? And John Ping is like, you know, he seems like he's taking responsibility. They're my wrongs. Of course, that's the right answer. It must be me. And Zhiyuan says, wrong. And then he says, hang on, why don't you stick around for the summer? Let's talk about this. We'll discuss these wrongs. In the Lankavatara Sutra, it says that we are like silkworms making cocoons, using the threads of our projections and our attachments to envelop ourselves and others. Quite an image. Building this cocoon that as it gets, you know, more complete, it closes out, in a sense, the world, right? But we're in a world that is the world. The footnote says he splits his guts and wounds his heart. That is, Zhiyuan is laying it out there. Everyone calls this a double case, a double bind. So there are many koans that are presenting us from within our struggle to break free of our experience and the living in sort of the views of living in a world that is divided and based in dualities. Everything is opposite everything else. Everything comes down to right or wrong. Everything comes down to whether it's painful or pleasurable. Everything comes down to what I want and what I don't want, which is the definition of dukkha. And so the koans, as a test, as an offering, as an invitation to free ourselves of that, in a sense, presents us with that very duality. That's why Zhiyuan says wrong. Because if we don't see it, how will we know that that's the world, that's my cocoon? But then he goes on to say, but in the midst of that, we don't realize that it's really just like putting water into water. It's like exchanging gold for gold. That within that perceived duality, nothing is divided. Within that sense of right and wrong, everything is at peace. And so koan really is life. It's just life. Right? I mean, there's a construction to it, obviously. Something happened that was very alive in that moment. It was uncontrived in the sense that it was happening. I mean, the teacher was obviously bringing this forth, but then it became, you know, a koan, a public case. It became something, right? And now it comes down to us. And so the challenge of it is, let it be life. Make it life, which doesn't mean turn it into metaphor. It doesn't mean try and relate it, you know, in a one-to-one correspondence with your life, you know, and sort of make it, you know, a kind of a, you know, an analogy, but really enter into the life of this. Just one moment of phenomena, one event. The self enters. When you enter into it, the self enters and is seen and is entangled. That's the discomfort of it. And so if Chan Ping had just ignored these wrongs, right? And he seemed like he was pretty proud of himself. So he might have done that. He was just like, you know, I'm not wrong. But then he would have cut himself off from the teacher, from a teaching. But if he just sort of abdicated to this wrong, then he would cut himself off from himself. You know, there are times when I was working on koans that I was not seeing over long periods of time. And I would go in and present my understanding again and again and again and again. And there were times where I wondered, is he trying to just see if I have confidence in my own insight? You know, in other words, if some is the koan, has he created the koan of am I, is the way to pass through this is by showing my confidence in my own understanding. But of course, he wasn't going to explain that to me. So on at least a couple of occasions, I thought maybe, because that's the only other thing I thought could be happening. And so I'd present that, but that didn't seem to be what was going on. Which is good, right? Because I was like, okay, I can let go of that. That's not a door. Start over. Go back. Start again. Give it life. And so to be free within right and wrong, we have to see through into the nature of right and wrong. Being wrong, how do you find your freedom? That isn't just to hell with that. And isn't just, I am that. Tian Ping came with a high sense of himself. That's clearly established. And what's interesting is how, you know, that, so the other side of humility, we can think of pride, of arrogance, and there's a lot in the teachings about pride as one of the kleshas, as one of the very sort of difficult states of mind to be caught in. And the inherent instability of that, the inherent insecurity of that. You know, and that's why arrogance has to be so strongly maintained and fortified and defended, because of its inherent insecurity. So when we have something, then that means we can lose something. That's why, you know, the monastics take a vow of simplicity. That's why our practice is sort of returning to a very, very basic state, an elemental state of being, so that then we can live within our world of things and conveniences and so on, but not be confused by them. They are not going to give us our happiness. They are not going to give us meaning and purpose in our lives. And so to cultivate a life of simplicity, to not have so many things. So Tian Ping is looking to the teacher to find out whether he's right or wrong. Are these two wrongs yours or mine? They're mine. Wrong. Jiwan wants him to see that the way is vast and boundless, free of right and wrong. And then live responsibly within right and wrong. the footnote, and so then Tianping leaves. He receives an invitation to a banquet. I mean, here the teacher's really excited. He said, why don't you stay? Let's talk about this. We'll discuss these. Not now. No, you have to stay. That's the deal. We will talk about this, but you have to stay in order to do that, right? If you want to move forward, that's what has to happen. Tianping says, nope. And the footnote says, or rather Hakuin says, commenting on this, says, his bow is broken, his arrows are gone, and yet his view of himself is not yet forgotten. Then, as now, it's hard to stay and face oneself. It's hard to face what is difficult to face. And we can think that we're moving away from that dis-ease, but really it only increases. And the more that increases, the more impetus there is to cover it up or distract ourselves away from it. And so that's why the simplicity of training is to try and not provide us with too many opportunities to do that. Because when we move away from it, it just lays dormant, but it's not really dormant at all. You know, I was thinking about this in terms of these wrongs. Residents yesterday, we didn't have a retreat this weekend, so we got together for the afternoon and watched the little clip of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking about the unnecessary nature of any kind of reparations towards African-American community within our country who helped in untold ways to build this country at great, great violence. And then we watched an interview. And so he basically was saying, we have no debt to pay. We have no responsibility. That happened a long time ago. None of us are part of it. It's over, done. And then we watched an interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates on Democracy Now!, which if you haven't seen it, I really recommend it, in which Ta-Nehisi, who presented, was the opening speaker at a congressional hearing to debate or consider this House Resolution 40, which would just examine what would reparations mean. And our Congress's decades-long unwillingness to even allow the possibility to ask the question. Talk about revealing, being transparent of our self, our national self. And so what happens when wrongs are not addressed, when karma is not attended to, when something appears before us, or we create something, which is what appears before us, that creates karma, that creates, which is consequence, and that continues and continues and continues, and we don't deal with it. It's not dormant at all. And that's what so many speakers have spoken about so eloquently, is that it's nothing goes away. I mean, this is just such a vivid example of the teaching and the reality of karma. Things do not go away. They just keep changing form. And so they change form in all of the many aspects of our country and our government and our institutions until the delusion becomes, just as it becomes integrated, fully integrated in our bodies and minds, such that if we don't do anything, that just keeps playing itself out because that's become our working system. So too on larger levels, if we don't see it, turn towards it deliberately, and we have to turn towards it deliberately, it's not just going to happen. Right? We're not just going to realize and free ourselves from our attachments. That's not just going to happen. Right? Those attachments, those karmic patterns are highly developed to stay in place. So we have to bring right effort, tremendous effort, deliberate attention, right intention, with good understanding, right understanding, and expend a considerable amount of energy, more than we think, and in a sustained way. And to see that as life's work in order to effect change. Nothing goes away. And when things don't go away, they not only change form, manifest in different forms, but they get larger and larger and larger. And so in the point where it says, do you think this is avoidance of direct confrontation, or does it have some other merit? How do we address what needs to be addressed? How do we see that events of 100 years ago or 400 years ago are manifest today, right here and now, within us as individuals, within our relationships, within this community, within our country? And that's why that basic principle of when something appears, practice it. Engage it now. I mean, just think about it. If at the end of the Civil War with emancipation, if we had actually said, okay, we're gonna deal with this, right? We're gonna do what we have not done. We're gonna actualize the governing principle, the founding principles of this country. We're actually gonna do it. It's gonna be a hellish kind of thing. Like I have no idea how we're going to do it, but we're going to do it. If there had been that, where would we be now? It's unimaginable, right? We literally cannot imagine it. So embedded in our country is this karma. But the fact that this very thing has come up, that this comes up over and over, this H.R. 40, this question of reparations, is because, not just because it hasn't been dealt with, but because it's happening now. We're not talking about something that happened 250 years ago. We're talking about something that's happening now, today. When we deal with our own karma, you know, things that happened a long time ago. We're not dealing with things that happened a long time ago. We may view it that way, but we're dealing with something that's happening right now. That's the power of it. It's also the shock of it, the challenge of it. And so we have to bring ourselves, be brought to, oftentimes, that's how it gets started, right? Life just gives you a whopper, right? Everything falls apart. It's not turning out the way you planned. Surprise! And that happens again and again. It's like, okay, like, let's just not keep doing the same thing and thinking it's going to work this time. What is a new way? Until we are not waiting for life to bring it to us, we bring ourselves to it. And the end of this koan, so John Ping leaves and he establishes his own community. Now he's a teacher in his own right. And one day he just happens to say, oh yes, I remember, years ago. In another translation, it actually says that years later he said, I was on pilgrimage and an evil wind blew me to Zhi Wan's place, just to give you a sense of how he saw it. But here he says it. I went to Zhi Wan's place. Twice in a row, he said wrong, and tried to keep me there over the summer to wait for him to deal with me. But I didn't stay. I didn't say it was wrong then, but when I set out for the South, I already knew it was wrong. Nothing goes away. There it is still. And to be sure, he has explained it to himself. He's rationalized. Why else would he be using it as a teaching? I already knew it was wrong. Wrong. When we don't take care of things. So many years later, still carrying this burden. And that's why he says in the poem that followers of the Chan house like to be scornful. It's easy to get caught in building ourselves up, letting go of one thing and taking on two more. Studying till our bellies are full, but not being able to put it to use. And this is really the deal, putting it to use. But we have to be in, where else would we be? We have to, wherever we are, means we have to be putting it to use. And there are many moments where we won't know what that means. I don't know what it means to put it into use. What's it? Is it my meditation? Is it the teachings? Is it my faith? Is it non-attachment? Yeah. Yeah, that all sounds good. Start there. Start anywhere. I remember in my first ango here in residence, just doing caretaking, something very simple, and thinking, I'm not quite sure what to do. How do I practice this? There was nothing complicated about the moment. There was lots of complication in my mind. It's hard for me to now even remember what did I not understand, right? But I remember in those moments feeling bereft of knowing, how am I supposed to be putting this to use? So we have to keep showing up. Until finally, as he says, Jiwan's pure wind suddenly melts him. The pure wind, the wind of Buddha nature, the wind of non-attachment, the wind of faith, of letting go. So I'll end with a poem. Having decided to relinquish this heavy load, be careful that you don't pick up another. Gold dust in your eyes will blind you. The habits of yesterday are not yet forgotten, and yesterday itself is a dream. Along the path to the heartland, traveling lightly is often best. Arriving naked and clean, now put on some clothes and come out to greet your guests. Arriving naked and clean, now get out of bed, feet on the ground, face the day.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.